You're listening to Signal to Noise on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. This episode is brought to you by the following sponsors: Allen & Heath and their new CQ series, a trio of compact digital mixers for musicians and bands, audio engineers, home producers, small venues, and AV installers, placing ease of use and speed of setup at the heart of the user experience. RCF, who just unveiled their new TT Plus audio brand, including the high-performance GTX series line arrays, and the GTS-29 subwoofer. Be sure to check it out at rcf-usa.com. That's rcf-usa.com. I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Signal to Noise. I'm your host, Andy Levis, and of course in the other chair is the one, the only, thank God, Sean Walker.
How you doing, Sean? What's up, y'all? I'm awesome, man. How are you?
Can you imagine if there were two of you?
Jesus Christ, bro. Don't put that hex on people. Come on. They're having a hard time wanting more of me.
Yeah, right?
What's going on in your world these days?
You know, just hanging, was doing a little bit of concert stuff the other week. I know a couple of weeks ago we talked about us mixing an oratorio back at the Perlman Center downtown, which was the venue y'all have heard way too much about when I was living there for 6 months last year.
Right, right.
And now it's been just, you know, a couple of weeks of corporate stuff, some stuff in town, going to head up to Rochester in a little bit and maybe see if I can finally put a face with a name with Nate once we get up there. And
Sweet.
Yeah, just hang and get that nice, sweet, sweet corporate day rate.
There you go. Hey, at least the Perlman's a nice venue to camp at. You know what I mean? I'm going to help a friend out tonight.
There's a complete and utter lack of daylight, which is weird, but that's theatering in a theater.
Yeah, yeah, right. Totally. I'm going to help a friend out tonight doing a bar gig, dude. First one in as long as I can remember. And I'm kind of excited, can I be honest, to like have a zero stress show. Like, if goes well, fine. If goes train wreck, dumpster fire, fuck it, fine. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I don't really mean that, but it's nice to not be like, some CEO is going to fire everybody on site right now if one little thing goes wrong. But if it's like, I don't know, kick two, went out. Well, fuck it, we can kick one.
You know, the corporate event I was just on as a system tech this year had the most ridiculous quantity of DMV V-Series line array in not a small room, but way small room for having four main arrays and three delay arrays.
Mm-hmm.
It only because last year they complained that they heard too much street noise, so they wanted to see more speakers this year. I don't think it was any louder than it was on that gig last year, but they saw a lot more speakers.
And your audio provider went, I'll send more speakers. Of course I will. Here's the new invoice.
Yeah, it was four main arrays of 8 each, so that's like 32 mains, and then another 3x6 of delays.
Yeah.
And there's maybe 15 or 20 feet between the main line and the delay line.
Perfect.
In a big square.
Yeah. Yep, and as a sound company, if we can get one more line of delays like that, sign me up, dude. Take that rental for the week, you know?
Right? I went from all house gear to like, we actually have to rent in 18 boxes. So that's what they did at that for that gig.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, talking about like bar gigs in ancient history and working in theaters, that kind of segues nicely to this week's guest, who I've known for longer than either of us cares to admit, and we're going to claim we were in diapers when we met because it was so long ago.
Nice. I love those friends.
Right? We have, I'm proud to be able to say now, Tony Awards winning Broadway sound designer, Jessica Paz. Hey, Jess.
Go, girl.
Hey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Awesome.
Doing all right. I'm awesome. Yeah, living the dream, you know? Living the dream.
So why don't we start there with where do you kind of start off and where that dream come in and how you got to where you are?
You know, it's pretty funny. I was, and I've said this in other interviews or articles before, was that I was one of those audience members that thought it was all just magic. I would go to see a show and it didn't even occur to me that there were people backstage, that there was someone mixing. Just sort of you know, by happenstance, I was seeing someone who performed in a community theater production of the Rocky Horror Show once a week. And so I'd go and dress up and do all the shoutbacks and everything. And I'd, you know, go every week. And eventually I decided that I didn't want to spend, you know, as a 19-year-old, I didn't want to spend $25 every week to see this show. And I started volunteering at the theater, and I ran a fog machine, and I did some automation, and I did some props and some backstage tracks. And then eventually they asked me to stage manage. I had no idea what that was, but I said yes. I figured it out as I went along. And then eventually there was just a show that sounded absolutely terrible, and it was just like Feedback City all the time. And it was a show I happened to love called Bat Boy the Musical. And I asked a friend, like, how do you do a sound check? And they described it to me. And I went in the next day and I did a sound check before the show. And we had a show that I can't say that it sounded good, but it didn't have any feedback. So that was great.
Sometimes sounding not terrible is a solid bar to aim for.
Is the solid part to aim for. Absolutely. And I kind of just dug it. And the really interesting thing about sound for me is that it's tedious in a way, and very detailed, and therefore it's almost impossible to get bored of. And I say this because I know myself. Because I've met myself and I've lived with myself for years.
22 or 23, like, at least, yeah, right? Yeah,
23, yeah. 23, exactly.
Yeah.
I will, you know, I wanted to be a bookkeeper. I wanted to be an accountant. I wanted to be a scuba diving instructor. I wanted to be the manager of a scuba diving store. I wanted to go to college to be a forensic psychologist. Obviously, all of these things did not come to fruition because I'm a theater sound designer. And I will say that of all of those other interests, you know, I'd get bored of them after about a year. And sound is the one thing that I've never gotten bored of. I feel like there's always something else to learn. You know, maybe not in the science of it, right? The physics of it, the science of it. All of the rules are the rules of the way sound functions. But the technology is consistently changing and updating, and you know, we're making new tools to do our work, and there's just always something to learn and implement. Yeah, that's sort of the short version of how I got where I'm going. And, you know, after that community theater, there were a number of assistant jobs, associate jobs, etc. Luckily, I was able to be the associate on Fela, the musical. I was blessed enough to travel with that to London and other European cities, and also take it to Nigeria, which was pretty incredible. Then more associate work, A2 work. I've hauled cables across football fields. I've done corporate stuff. I've done a lot of mixing in bars and music venues with a box of SM57s, and you just got to make it sound good. And it's kind of how you learn, I think. So, yeah, I've sort of done it. I've done it all. And then eventually got a design on Broadway with Hadestown, which is wonderful.
That's awesome. A little show nobody's heard of.
So for those of us not in the theater world, what does a theater sound designer do?
It's a little different whether it's a play or a musical. It's a little bit different if you are also composing and sound designing. Let's just talk about, you know, a play. So I will come in. And in smaller venues, there may very well be a sound system already in place. And so then I will come in and augment that sound system with other equipment or not. And then I will create the content for the show, which can be, if there is no composer attached, writing original music, would be me editing music to fit certain moments. For instance, POTUS, which was a play on Broadway, I specified the sound system, and then we used all found music for the transitions, etc., which I had to edit to fit into those like 10-second moments where we spun the set around. And what happens is the producers then have to go and license that music so that the artists get paid for their music being used. If it's a composer coming in writing original music, then that music doesn't get licensed because it's being written for the show by that person. And I've done shows where there has been a composer and also me. So I would deal with the amplification and the sound effects and the specifications of the sound system, and the composer would write all of the music. And so then I take their music and implement it across the sound system, and we kind of bring our two mediums together. For a musical, it's similar in the sense of, you know, I'm specifying a sound system. I'm specifying probably a beefier sound system for a musical than I am a play. And it depends on the venue, the architecture of the space, the needs of the show, etc. But the goal is always to make sure that every audience member hears the same show within a certain amount of tolerance, right? Because you can't make it absolutely perfect in every single seat. And then, you know, I'm speccing everything from the microphone that the actor wears on their head to the transmitter that they wear on their body that sends their voices to other equipment in, you know, amp land in racks into the trap room, which is under the stage. And that then comes into the sound console. And then there's a person who every day mixes the show line by line, which means that, you know, there are never more microphones open than need to be. And they respond to the actor's performance every day. I then, you know, will create sound effects as needed for the musical. There's the implementation of various, you know, reverbs, effects. You know, the bigger the show, the larger the console. There's also monitoring equipment for the musicians. The microphones that are used for those musicians and each of those chairs. There's, you know, implementing speakers within the scenery or the floors to provide information to the actors on stage for what they need to hear in terms of their note or tempo information, etc., and so on. So basic, and down to like you get a Broadway theater, you get four walls and a bunch of seats. There's no cable, there's no speakers, there's no, there aren't even speakers in the dressing rooms. We provide all of that. If there are, I God bless. I always love it when there are. But we bring in everything. So right down to the tape that the backstage audio person called the A2 is using to affix a microphone cabled wire to someone's neck. I mean, we spec it all.
So that's awesome. Yeah, like, correct me if I'm wrong, just to restate for the folks in the music world and kind of categorize it, as far as the mixing goes, there, just like in the concert world, there are two folks who encompass the broad spectrum of the sound. In the concert world, you've got the SE and the mixer, the A1. In the concert world, the A1 decides how it should sound, mixes it, and it's the SE's job to make the system balance, to make that happen and make it so that what the mixer wants is what's happening across the theater, in the or across the venue. In the theater world, we have two people, we have the same tasks, they get divided up a little bit differently. So the sound designer basically has the SE role plus the choices over what microphones go where and how it sounds, and all the mixer does is mix.
Yes. However, I will add to that when I am working with someone who's my engineer, the A1, and I have a longstanding relationship with them and a rapport, and our styles are similar, which is likely why I chose them to mix that show. It can become really freeing. Yes, I decide artistically what microphone I want on what instrument and what actor and what the equipment is, etc. But then having someone who's behind the console, who I trust and whose ears I trust, and who shares my aesthetic, I don't have to be commenting on what the show sounds like all the time. Or I can be, you know, down front listening and then come back and talk to them and be like, that felt like that bit was a little too loud and I think we want more reverb there and here's how the moment needs to feel. I don't have to give them exact numbers on a fader or values. I do sometimes, but like I said, if it's someone that we kind of then share the artistic vision, and the way I like to describe it is talking about, you know, Allison and I on A Beautiful Noise. Allison was the A1, and we have a relationship from the Hadestown tour, which is how I met her. I will often say that she is my hands, or any A1. They're my hands because I can't touch the console, right? As the designer. I mean, I can, but I can't mix the show. So she has to mix the show, and I have to communicate to her how I want the show to sound. And I'm her feet, right? She can't leave the console and go walking around the room. So she has to trust that what I'm telling her is accurate for what it sounds like everywhere else that she can't be. And I have to trust her to tell me what it feels like under her hands as she's mixing it, because I don't have that tactile information.
Totally. Yeah, that makes sense. The best relationships I've had as a mixer with designers and vice versa are, yeah, when there is that trust and that, both knowing what the designer is going to want before they ask for that, or the designer waiting to give you a chance to respond before they tell it to you. Like I've had experiences on shows with a designer that I've known but haven't worked with before, where like they'll like with line by line mixing, as Jess was talking about, it's one of the big things we talk about is that we do a lot of the dynamics for vocals with our fingers. You know, so it'll be like, you don't have any compressors. No, I have 10 right here at the end of my hands. Mm-hmm. And it's a very dynamic responding to what the actor is doing. And I've had shows where like a new designer I'm working with will start off kind of somewhat aggressively setting the dynamics, not knowing what they're going to get and wanting to make sure in like tech rehearsals stuff doesn't get out of hand. And it's like that great joy to watch as I'm mixing, watch that threshold slowly creeping further and further out of my way as they realize what I'm doing and are like, oh, you got this, you don't need that, and responding to each other that way.
It's sort of like I hate the term training wheels. It's just a way to get the show into a stable position. You know, you're kind of designing from the 10,000 foot view and then the 5,000 foot view and then the 1,000 foot view and then the 500 foot view down. And like every pass that you make at it just gets you like deeper and deeper into the onion until you get to the center of the Tootsie Pop. and
who doesn't love a Tootsie Pop? I mean,
yeah. And, you know, it gets more and more detailed. So now, depending on the style of the show, if it's a rock show or a pop show, I may have more aggressive compression than I would on, you know, a spoken word poetry piece or a jazz style piece as well. But again, it is what Andy's saying, is that it's just a protection. And then once the A1 is comfortable and they know the show and they're, you know, doing, I will loosen that up and just give them more freedom.
Totally. And is it a safe bet to speculate that the system specifications vary widely based on the venue and the needs, like it would in a concert, where it could be from like X32 and speakers on sticks to Ravage or Digico with Meyer or whatever, you know what I mean? Or some kind of big line array where maybe it makes more sense? Or is it all pretty much a like, here's the people really want and we'll really use? Like, what does the specification look like for something like this audio-wise?
You know, it starts with the room, right? Because there's a few things, especially dealing with a musical. It begins with the room, the shape of the room, where you can physically hang speakers. And then from there, you figure out what speakers can fit in those spaces that are, you know, have a throw that's the width that you'd like. And then you decide, well, what kind of, you know, what kind of show is this? Do I want to use a point source speaker as my main left rights? Or is this a big giant rock musical? Do I want to use line arrays? Right. And then in the case of something like Beautiful Noise, I think this is worth saying, is that the show goes from these incredibly intimate scenes with two people speaking and in casual conversations. It's a therapist and the older Neil, recalling his life. So there's these two person, like super intimate scenes that are very much like a play. And then we have to be able to go from that to a stadium concert sound, right? So how do you do that? We could do an A-B system in which the play vocals in those scenes are through point source speakers, or we can say, well, if we, like, what is the biggest we need to get? Let's accommodate for that, which are these giant concert stadium moments. Let's make sure we can handle that with the PA, because we can always make things smaller, right? But you can't necessarily drive a PA that isn't powerful enough to achieve a stadium moment. And then you're also looking at the, you know, the therapist and the older Neil sort of weaving themselves with dialogue in and out of the storytelling, in and out of these concert moments. Like sometimes we're going from two-person scene to concert all within the same 60 seconds. So, you know, yeah, I guess my point being is that I want to spec for the system what is going to achieve the largest I need to get so that I can then bring moments back as needed instead of trying to make a system do what it can't do. If that answers absolutely. Your question.
I mean, yes. Ultimately, I was trying to picture in my mind, like, how big is theaters or rooms? Is it something that has, typically speaking, are there like left, right, center line arrays or clusters, or, you know what I mean? Like, can you describe in more detail what systems you often find yourself specking or falling on? And I don't necessarily care about the brand, but more about like point source here or line array there, or, you know, if there's a brand, that's fine. But like, how is that different from concerts, you know what I mean, or corporate events, which is what I'm used to, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, when I've done some outdoor venue concerts, it's, you know, line array stacks left and right and like subs under the bottom of the stage and like front fills that sit on top of those, or maybe front fills sit on the edge of the deck. There's monitor wedges. You know, there's none of that in theater. There are small speakers set into the floor. So there are monitors, but it's not wedges like you would see in a concert venue. I tend to like line arrays very much, and especially the newer models that have been coming out the last 5 to 10 years. I mostly go with either Meyer or D&B in terms of brand. And I always say, oh, like, let me play my little violin. I have to choose between $1 million sound system and another. Like, they're both wonderful.
Totally.
An embarrassment of riches. You know, and I choose one manufacturer over another based on, you know, what I'm doing, but
sure.
You know what it is though? I tend to stick with the manufacturers I know because it's a tool that I continue using. It's a color in my palette. It's something that I know what it's meant to sound like. And so therefore I know whether or not something sounds correct or not. Right. I know that I have this console, I have these speakers, I have these amplifiers. I expect it to sound like this. It's sort of like, I'll give an example. The snare drum doesn't sound good. Okay, what microphone are you using? And I once like tried this you know, weird new microphone, and I just could not get this snare drum to sound right. And so we were like, all right, who's got a 57? if it doesn't sound right on a 57, then there's something else that's wrong, because you should be able to just put a 57 on a snare and it's fine.
Sure.
Without all that much effort. So that's part of why I tend to give myself the same tools over and over, not because I don't ever change things. I do. I'm just careful about how many new things I introduce to a production, because I want to have my toolbox. It's like, you know,
they're tried and true. You're getting paid for a result, and you need the tools you can to get your result. That makes sense. Totally.
Right. Like, I'm not going to try to drill into brick unless I have a hammer drill, because I'm going to be there for a while with that one.
Totally.
I have a story about that from the Harry Potter loading. But that's for another.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
All right. So you like line arrays when you can, presumably for the coverage out front and the directivity behind it to the side, while you got open headsets and lavaliers and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, and so generally speaking, my center clusters will be line arrays, unless the proscenium is lower than I expect, and then I might be able to get away with point source, or if there's a sight line issue and I can't use a line array. For instance, Hadestown on the West End, the proscenium arch is very, very high. It's over 30 feet. I think it's 32 feet or something. Usually we're at like 29 feet to the top-ish. And this is exceptionally high, and the theater is four levels high for seating, and so the sightline angles get very, very steep, and there's just no way that we would be able to put a 6 or 8 box line array at the center position. So we had to use point source speakers for that, but then we did line arrays left and right, and all of the fill speakers, so there's duplicates of the left and right, sort of halfway through the house, that just bring that left-right signal back further. I like line arrays for a left-right because it also gets really shoots into that under balcony well in a way that isn't as clean as a point source. Like, I can get very, very specific. And it also means that, you know, a point source may fall off by the time you get to that overhang, and a line array doesn't. It almost gets all the way to the back of the theater, which I like. But everything other than around the main proscenium is all point source speakers. So the under balcony speakers are point source, the surrounds, the fill speakers, all of that is point source.
That makes total sense. That's awesome. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, somewhere maybe to go for that, like, we've mostly been indirectly talking about like a show on Broadway, the West End, that's a sit. What about, do you want to talk a little bit about translating one of those shows to a tour, and which then brings the same show into a much larger variety of venues, and how you make the choices for what works and done, and how to translate that?
So for designing a tour, and I'll speak about Hadestown specifically, to rewind, to tell people, we make these predictions, these speaker predictions, when we're deciding what sound systems we want to install in these theaters. So it's usually a section. Sometimes we can do these things in 3D, which helps us to envision the speaker with the coverage pattern and how that's going to interact with the space. And whether or not the amount of speakers we have and their capabilities are going to actually do what we expect them to do. And so for a tour, there are additional challenges, which are that you're traveling towers left and right, and then you have to make sure that your towers can accommodate a two-level theater, a three-level theater, a four-level theater. So what I did was I took the sections of each of those venues throughout the first year of the tour. Some of them can be 1,000-seat houses, some can be up to 5,000 seats. And I, you know, choose how to pin the arrays to see if I can accommodate all of those venues with a single set of towers and a single center cluster. Sometimes we don't have to hang our own center cluster. We can use one that's already installed in the venue. Some venues have them already. We will often tie into delay systems and fill systems that the venue has installed, which a lot of roadhouses do because they get shows coming through there all the time. We will travel some fill speakers and some delay speakers for like under balconies and things to use as needed. Sometimes we'll choose to use the ones that we bring over what the venue has installed. And it's, you know, then you start getting into constraints of we have X amount of room on the truck. So does sound get an entire truck or do we have to fit into half a truck? And are we sharing that with musicians? And, you know, and then what happens is, you know, on Broadway, we're doing a prediction for that singular venue. Before we go in, we install the sound system, the show runs. On the road, my engineer, and this is, I think, a little bit more like the concert world, Andy, it's the A1 who's deciding what the show sounds like based on what they've learned from what the designer's desires are, right? They have to go and then replicate that at every venue. They have to do new predictions. They have to pin the arrays the way that they need to be, and they have to make sure that the show sounds as good as it can sound and as true to its design as possible in that new space. And they have to do it. Usually they get like 8 hours to install the entirety of the system if there's no advance call. But they maybe get an hour of quiet at every new venue to see if it sounds right.
Yeah, it's a lot of running again.
Intense.
Yeah, there are many venues where it's more damage control than it's. I'm gonna try and make it sound the least unlike what it should sound like as it can.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
That's intense.
Mm-hmm.
Same things happen in corporate or concert, right? You're making predictions and flying arrays, and you know, trying to make it sound the same in every seat. But have it a go from a 1,000, 5,000 cap and the same thing. Like, you got to have a lot of PA truck because those are very different specs in my mind for what a PA takes to do a 5,000 cap versus a 1,000 cap, right? I mean, same in theater.
Surprisingly, the towers are the towers are the towers are the towers. They are the same towers if it's 1,000 seats as it is if there's 5,000 seats. So in the bottom of the tower, the bottom section is from floor up, it's a subwoofer and then two point source speakers. So for a fill and an inner and an outer, right? And then above that is four Leopards. And that's the bottom of the tower. So that's about 8 feet. And then above that is another 8 foot section of tower that's got eight Leopards in it. And so it's just about the way you pin it. And they're on these gimbals. So you can actually take the whole yoke and just point that upper line array directly at like the back seat of the highest balcony. and then of course you're tying into these larger venues very often, if not always, have their own delay systems hung for those additional balconies that super we tie helpful. Into.
Super yeah. helpful. So then you just take yeah. your Galileo or Lake or whatever you like and set those to match what you're off and running.
Exactly.
Killer.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So, I mean, with like, you know, basically what I'm saying is, yes, these towers accommodate it, but without fill systems that the venues provide, we would in certain situations fall short.
Right. I get you. All right, cool. That's awesome.
So yeah, and then you go to the Kansas City Starlight and all bets are off. So for those, the Starlight is one of the major Broadway touring houses, but it is an outdoor amphitheater, which is nothing like any of the other venues any tour that goes through there ever is prepared for.
Oh, that's funny.
Right. And outside is really interesting. You know, I designed for about 7 years out at the Delacorte in Central Park, which is an 1,800-seat venue. We've done musicals, we've done plays. It's a lot of Shakespeare, a lot of rewritten Shakespeare, reimagined Shakespeare. And it's just really interesting to work outside because there are no walls. There is nothing for the sound coming out of a speaker to reflect off of back onto the stage. It just goes out. which is in some ways really freeing because it will sound exactly the way you want it to sound, but also in some senses a bit jarring because there are no walls. There's just no slapback. And the slapback actually helps the performers, right? Because they're hearing the reflection of the room coming back at them in addition to whatever speakers I'm providing them on the stage. And then you take that away, the only thing they have to rely on is what's in the speakers that I have on the stage, because they don't hear any reflection.
So, and when you're doing stuff in the Delacorte, are you putting more vocals in Foldback than you would otherwise?
I put vocals in Foldback on just about every single show I do now.
Go on. I joke and tease because it is a long-standing thing in theater that because we've got 1,000 Omni mics everywhere, we for a long time have been very resistant to putting vocals in Foldback at all.
So 100%.
Good to know. Okay.
And it gets really, really tricky when it's a lavalier worn in like a hairline position. And then there's like some tricks that I employ to handle that. It's much harder in those situations. Most of my shows are, the actors are wearing boom microphones. So they're wearing headsets, which, you know, puts the microphone right at their mouth. And I get a lot more headroom in the onstage speaker systems, and I can get away with it and get away with it really well. And so then, you know, I want to give that to them, but I also set up separate paths to the speakers that are on stage. So for instance, I will do a, you know, each of the speaker systems on stage is coming from an aux. So it has its own mix, and I can, you know, make different mixes across the stage. So, you know, the speakers that are really close to the drums probably don't need drums in them, right? And I certainly don't want to put strings in the speakers that are right near the strings because I don't want feedback, right? So I have those separate mixes. However, when it comes to vocals, what I do is I set up an aux called Vocals to Stage. That aux then returns to an input of the desk, and that input, that return input, then routes to all of the speaker systems on stage. So no matter where the actor is moving, they're getting the same amount of their voice, ideally the same amount of their voice, no matter where they go on the stage. And that allows me to, not only do I then EQ the speakers themselves to make their signal flat, make their frequency response flat, but then I also get to EQ the vocal to stage return, which means I then get even more finite control over any problematic frequencies that I may run into just with the vocal mics themselves and that vocal mix. It also allows me to put some compression on the vocals to stage, which I want because I want there to be an upper limit to how loud those monitors can get, right? If I don't give it an upper limit, and this is for a number of reasons, I want to give it an upper limit because I don't ever want something louder than I'd like for it to be coming back through the microphones in an uncontrolled way. But also, there's no monitor engineer who's actively listening to what's happening on the stage because there isn't a person. All of those vocals coming through monitors are controlled by the front of house engineer who's in the back of the room, nowhere near the stage. So it's a bit of a puzzle to set up, but once it's set up and it's functional, the engineer knows that it's safe to throw that fader to a specific place and there it's not going to be a problem, right? So it's just a matter of some trickery.
Yeah, cool.
But different than the concert world in the sense that there is no monitor engineer. And that's not to say that there isn't ever.
Sure.
There are some shows that do have monitor engineers, but that would be like a show like Fela, where, you know, you have to support a musician, an actor who never leaves the stage, right? So, and so, yes, we had a monitor engineer on that, but it's becoming less and less likely. I think I went down a bit of a rabbit hole in some of that, but hopefully
no, that's
that
awesome.
Covers
We're
what you're...
podcast hosts. We make a living on going down rabbit holes.
Yeah, totally.
Fantastic.
That's awesome. So you must have a preferred console tool set also, right? Is that yeah, typically a Yahoo or DigiCo platform or Avid? Like, how much trickery do you need built into your desk to make this all work, you know?
I guess that goes back to the conversation about having the right tools, right? It's like, what's better, the tool that can do all the fancy things with that you don't really know very well, or the tool that you know like the back of your hand and therefore can make do anything, right? with that said, I stick to Digico. Yamaha is just everywhere, so it's ubiquitous in terms of concert venues and all of that. So I think every audio engineer knows Yamaha desks. But for my bigger shows, yeah, it's Digico. And at this point, I just know it so well that, and I am so fast at it, that moving to something else would just be detrimental, I think, to the process.
Totally.
Right.
And to their credit, Digico spent many, many years listening and seeking out support from those of us in the theater community and adding so many tool sets for us that others at like Rivage in the last couple of versions have added like theater mode features that start to get closer to there. But there's just so much power there for the unique quirks of how we need to work in theater that other consoles don't necessarily have, even if they have other bells and whistles that would be great.
Right. Totally. I mean, again, it's like the choice between an Avid desk, a Rivage, and a Digico. You know, again, play me my little violin. I'm choosing between three different multiple $100,000 consoles.
they're all world-class platforms. I wasn't asking which one was platform.
Not at all.
The right tool set for you?
For me, it's the Digico, and it's the Digico because I know it so well, because it handles theater as well as it does, and because I find that the maintenance of a show, a running show, is a little bit simpler on a Digico because of the feature called Players. So you could just say, oh, Sally's on for ensemble member number three today instead of so-and-so, or there's a sub-guitarist today. And so you can choose the Players, which then brings over their EQs, their compression, specific to that person.
Oh my God, right? That's amazing.
And again, that's not to say there are ways to go about that with the Yamaha desk, and there are ways to go about that with the Avid desk. None of these are, you know, they're all, again, like you said, world-class platforms.
They're just not as slick or as easy as this. Yeah, I gotcha.
Well, should we blow Sean's mind and tell him about aliases too?
Please do.
Oh my gosh.
I'm interested. Yeah, I've never done a theater show, so I'm stoked. This is awesome.
So basically, a Digico with its theater software, I'll try to explain this as simply as possible for a person who's never seen it before.
For me, thanks.
Is that the desk itself will function as if it's analog until you tell it not to. For instance, you dial inputs into auxes, you make EQ changes, all of that. It ripples through every cue of the show until you decide that, you know, Sally wears a hat in scene number two. And she wears a lav at the forehead position. She wears this hat. And this, you know, when she puts the hat on, it makes her mic sound not great because it's reflecting off the brim of the cap. And so you can do things like add felt to the cap to make it less reflective. But then you can do something on the desk called an alias. And so this desk that has been operating as analog this whole time, until you tell it not to, which you're going to do in scene two for Sally wearing a hat, you can say, I need this input channel to have an alias only for this cue. And in that cue, Sally will have a different EQ that will accommodate the hat. And then in the very next scene, she'll go back to her standard EQ. And the standard EQ that is now in all of the scenes of the show except scene two, if you make a change to that EQ while you're in any of the other scenes, will ripple to all the other scenes in which that EQ exists. But it won't change the EQ that's in scene two for the hat.
And you can use it for like instruments too. So like if you're going between a nylon and a steel and you don't want to eat up two channels for that because you know he's never playing it at the same time, you do an alias for the nylon that changes the gain, the dynamics, the EQ, But then also, he's got new strings on today, and the nylon sounds a little weird, and you got to EQ around it a little different. Every time that nylon comes back in, those changes will track. That is so cool. And Ravage has added a similar, although slightly more limited thing in their theater mode now called Banks. So for those of you who use Ravage, if you try, and there's some concert engineers on both of those consoles that specify the T software on the Digico or the theater software on the Ravage for those tools and how they're applicable to concerts too. They're not just for theater, although they're primarily designed
for theater. I was just thinking you could use that alias thing for a guitar solo. Like if it was all on time code, you could just alias for guitar solo, it gets a little bit brighter so you don't have to like crank it up 2 million dB, but all of a sudden your solo's sticking out. God, that's so cool. Yep. All right, I want one.
Yeah, there's
I want one. We'll call my digi guy.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's awesome. I mean, I have no use for it, but now I just like.
Now you just want it. Yeah, exactly.
Is that available on all the Digi consoles, or just a select?
Most of that. Any of
like
them
the new Quantums, like a 225 or 338 would have that.
Yes, yeah. You cannot do T software on an SD8. You cannot do T software. There are some that cannot accommodate T software, but T software is a bit of software that sits on top of the console software.
Understood. Yeah, basically it's the theater package on top of their software. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the more budget models don't necessarily have that option because they've got scaled on processors that can't accommodate it and or because that's not the market they're targeting that console for. But at this point, most of them.
25 or 338 probably have that option. You would think?
I believe so. Yes.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty freaking cool.
And once it's on there, it's like, you pay for that license. And then there's just like a setting screen you go into. You tick a box and check in. And it's definitely one of those things it's not a thing you want to enable without really reading the manual to understand how it works because it's this overlay software on top of the regular console software. If you don't start building a show with it in mind and knowing you're going to use it, shit can get weird.
Yeah, there's like 1,000 ways to hurt yourself when you're when you're programming the desk to start tech. And the first time I did it, many, many years ago at this point, I started over at least a handful of times because I was like, oh, you got to do that thing first. And then it's actually easier.
And to their credit at this point, DigiCode does have a guide that says, here's a guide to using the T software. Here's what you need to do. And in big bold print, decide how many mixes you could possibly need. Add some extras. Build those first. Because if you try adding mixes, for example, later, it's going to screw up things based on how the T software interacts with it. So it's just a thing to it's not a thing you want to add into the middle of the game.
But this is Andy, this is assuming that people like me read instruction manuals.
No, people like you hire people like me who read instruction manuels.
I knew I liked her. See, Jessica and I are on the same page. Like, I don't know, I'll figure it out. And you're like, hey man, that's actually not going to work that way. It's fine, Andy. It's fine. We'll get there.
I mean,
we're working.
Look, I'm at this point in my life and career predominantly a Yamaha guy. When I'm on a Digico, I'm perfectly happy. But you can bet your ass I've got Zach Jack's number on speed dial.
Yeah, right.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I still have to call Zach every single time that I set up the iPad app to be used with an SD10. Because for some reason, when I set it up with an SD7, it connects and it works. It's just like magic, like it's supposed to. But when I try to set it up with an SD10, it does not want to be happy for me. And I have to call him every time. And so every time I call him, I said, you would think that by now I would have written this down. So that I don't have to call you.
But he's also just nice to talk to.
100%. But then I'd have reason to call him. So
yeah, for those who don't know, Zach Jack is the go-to Digico autograph support guy, particularly for the Northeast and for Broadway. He lives in Manhattan, and he's the officially sanctioned, officially employed by Digico phone a friend for everybody on Broadway, as well as other markets too. And we all know and love him and ask him stupid questions all the time. And he's very kind with answering them. Like, we're not entirely stupid.
I love
and sometimes he comes out and makes a visit if needed. Right. But yeah, he's lovely. He's wonderful and very knowledgeable. And he always has the answers. And if he doesn't, he calls Germany, right? It's Germany?
England. Rural England, so almost Germany.
Sure, yes. Yeah, that's really... He's great. He's great. And they're a good company.
Yeah, and so I know we talked about Hadestown a bit, and then we sort of mentioned introing that courtesy of your work on Hadestown, you won a Tony Award for sound design, and were shockingly and sadly, or not shockingly sounds wrong, because it sounds like I'm shocked you won, but which I am not, but sadly we'll say, despite how many years into having a sound design Tony it was, which that itself is another conversation for how few those many years were.
Sure.
You were the first female to win an award.
Yes. So
congrats.
Thank you very much. I believe that was the 70s. It's either the 73rd or the 76th. I forget which one. It's one. In any case, the first woman to ever be nominated for a sound design Tony was 10 years prior to me, which was Cricket Myers for Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. And she was nominated for best sound design of a play. Up until me, there had been no woman ever nominated for best sound design of a musical. And then I won. So that made me the first to win a sound design Tony, period. So... and I believe, refresh my memory, I know that the Tony for sound was like suspended in 2012, but came back in 2014.
Yeah.
But when was the first year that we had a Tony? Was that like 07 or 08, something like that?
Whatever South Pacific was, but hang on, I'm going to ask our friend Google.
Mm.
2008, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looks like 2008.
2008. Yeah, 2008. So 2008 was the beginning of there even being a Tony for sound, period.
Yeah, and then there were 2 years that they didn't.
Yeah, there were 2 years that it was not in place. But so during those 2 years, there was a special sound Tony for Gareth Fry, who did The Encounter.
Yeah, which is, I don't know if it still streams. There was a stream of it at one point, and it is super cool to watch because it was a show that was presented with a performer making, like, basically live sound effects and performing both into a narration mic and a binaural head, and everybody in the audience had headphones. Mm-hmm. So you could hear all the stuff in, like, 3D space around you, and it was fucking wild.
It was really cool. And it was very cool.
It's like super cool to see it live, but the fact that it was done binaurally means that it also streams really well, because as long as you put on a pair of headphones, you're getting a pretty close experience.
Yeah, it's wild. And it's about his journey through the Amazon, and which is also just fascinating.
Yeah, it's a super cool story. And while we're talking about that gap in the Tonys, I'll refer for us back and we'll link in the show notes. We had another mutual friend of mine and Jessica's, Lindsay Jones, was on a while back, and we kind of dive a little bit more into that story and how the award came and went.
I loved hanging out with John Malkovich, dude. That was great.
Yeah.
Sorry, he Lindsay. Does look like John Malkovich.
Yeah.
We spent far too much time on that.
I loved it. And episode, I really,
much to his chagrin.
I just thought John was the nicest dude. You know what I mean?
And yes, Lindsay knows the backstory of all of that far better than I do, you know, with the collaborator party and that was how TSDCA came about, which is the Theatrical Sound Designers and Composers Association, which I'm co-chair of the board with John Malkovich. but yes, he is more keen on all the details of how that.
Oh, we know. He gave us all the details. We talked to him. All of them.
Yeah, fantastic. So if folks want to go back in the show notes, you can hear both about that and how the TSDCA grew out of that and a little more about that. So we'll link that up for you.
Do you want to hear anything about like some of the trickery that goes on in Hadestown?
Absolutely.
Shit, yeah, I do.
We were coming around to the point of, is there anything we should have asked you that we didn't? And also, yeah. I was going to ask specifically, I know Hadestown is somewhat very specifically known for certain spots where you use Ear Trumpet Labs mics that I think folks would dig hearing about.
Oh, well, so originally those mics were live. They are not live anymore. They are used as props, but we fake it.
Okay. With
sound design. So whenever I'm designing a show, I try to think of, like, what are the rules, right? Like, what are the rules? And what are the rules that I came up with for Hadestown was that the narrator never has reverb, ever, ever. Ever, ever. So Hermes, no reverb. Because they're in the story, but outside of the story. And therefore, like, that sets them apart, but not so apart. Just a convention, right? And it's not to say we can't break those rules. It's just starting from somewhere. You kind of have, like, want parameters. And, but everyone else is in reverb all the time. Like, there's everybody all the time. So the way that we
even for dialogue,
yeah, but there's very little. Well, maybe not dialogue, but there's very little dialogue in the show. It's like either talk sung or sung through the whole time. So maybe there's one or two moments where there's people aren't in reverb for dialogue, but it's so rare. So because we have a triple turntable on the stage, we can't have a wired microphone trailing a cable across the automation. And I suppose we could have made it wireless, but that would require, you know, hiding transmitters. And so what we did was we used this double-headed mic now as a prop. And the way that we fake it is, so whenever Hermes uses it, there's a duplicated input. There's Hermes. Hermes has three channels. There's Hermes, which is just their mic. There's the Hermes Evelyn, which is the name of that Ear Trumpet Labs microphone. And what we do is that duplicate input is like DigiTube, is like the tube emulation on the input channel at like 30. It's like really high. And that gets sent to basically gets bussed out to the system in the same way that the effects reverb gets bussed out. So what happens is every time Hermes steps up to that microphone, they get this like crunchy tube emulation that then puts them in the surrounds. So he just gets a little bigger. It's very subtle. He gets a little bigger and a little crunchier. And then in the moment when we get to Wait For Me, which is like one of the penultimate number, the 11 o'clock number in Act One, the original thing was a push-to-talk mic, which we made wireless and worked and had this specific sound. And in London, we cut that microphone. And then all of a sudden, that push-to-talk became the Evelyn, but not on a stand. And then I was like, oh my God. And I deleted all of that stuff that did the push-to-talk mic. So I had to make up like what we were going to do to make this sort of radio effect. And so I just used that input that we made for when Hermes is on the Evelyn sort of normal, but instead I turned the DigiTube all the way up to maximum. So now it just sounded and like bandpassed the EQ. So now I had this fully wide open dry sound of Hermes and then the wet on top of it layered in. So I have 100% dry signal and 100% wet signal as opposed to doing some sort of like mix balance. I didn't want to jeopardize the fullness of the dry signal. I just wanted to layer something on top of it. So that's how we fake the mic for Hermes. And then we fake it with reverb for Hades when he uses it, which makes him sound like he's like coming through every speaker in Hadestown. He's just like this booming voice. And then we use that same effect, but we have it for Persephone when she uses the mic, which is just this subversive, like, I'm using Hades' microphone. So that's how we do the mic. There are moments in the show where, the other channel for Hermes is what I call the whistle. So Hermes has this train whistle that they blow at various points throughout the show. And it's got this long, like 6.5 second decay on it, this like long metallic reverb that just makes it sound huge. So that's a duplicate input, and that sends to the effects reverb engine. So it's the fully dry Hermes mic, and then the duplicate of their headset mic that sends to the reverb for this whistle. And another fun thing we do is with a subharmonic synth. So, well, that's a whole different thing. is with the kick drum. There's two songs in the show called Chant 1, Chant 2. And they have this very driving, pounding tempo and rhythm. And so I have the kick drum microphone. I have an outer and an inner. And then I have a duplicate of the inner mic. And the input to that, it's not actually a duplicate, I'm sorry. The input to this oscillator channel is an oscillator that's on the desk, tuned to 55 hertz, which is the key of the songs. And it has a gate on it that's always closed and only opens when the kick inner mic hits. And it opens for like 2 milliseconds, but it just adds this like 55 hertz bump in the subs, only in those two numbers of the show. And in the very last number, the entirety, it's a song called Doubt Comes In. The entirety of that song is done with only the kick oscillator, which is just elongated. And there's no actual kick drum microphones turned on in that moment at all. So it's just this long, like, woofy kick drum.
Now I want to go back and see the show again.
Dude, cool.
there's a couple things. One of the fun bits is that right before the show went to Broadway, I was reading a magazine, I think it was in Mix Magazine or Front of House or something, about Ani DiFranco and the way she sets up her guitars for her concerts. And she's actually in the show right now, which is really wonderful. And so I was reading this article and I learned that she's got like a series of pedals in front of her. And then she's got a mic, a DI, and then she has an amp off stage that has a mic on it. And with her pedals, she can decide how much mic, DI, or amp she wants for each individual guitar. And she's got a bunch of guitars, of course. And so I asked Anais, the writer of Hadestown, who used to be on Ani DiFranco's record label, to call Ani and be like, tell me the details of like what it is exactly that she does. And I woke up one day, a few weeks later, to an 8-minute long voicemail of Ani DiFranco describing how her guitars are set up.
That's cool.
And so then I learned this. And so Orpheus's guitar, he plays this like 3/4 sunburst Gibson guitar, is wireless. We use the pickup with a transmitter. And then I duplicate. So it's a dry channel with just EQ on it. And then I duplicate that and I send that to an amplifier, an amp emulator. And it's like a tweed amp, and I just mix that in some amount underneath the guitar to just beef it up, put it in the surrounds, give it some harmonics, and it's worked out really well for those moments.
Dude, that's
when
cool.
Orpheus is using it.
That's awesome.
It was pretty fun. Yeah, it was pretty fun. Anything else that we do. Yeah, I think that's most of it. Yeah.
So what about, do you want to talk briefly about Beautiful Noise? I know one thing that occurs to me that I would love to hear is we recently had Bert and Ishmael, who mixes Madonna's current tour, on. And one of the things we talked to him about was taking all these very like period-specific songs and making them work in ways that are true to what we remember of those songs and what we hear on the albums, but also translates to a modern audience. And I'm curious how I imagine similar dynamics come into play with doing a musical about Neil Diamond in 2023, 2024.
Yes. And, you know, part of it is that there has to be a decision made in the early creative process about what equipment you're going to use, right? There are significantly more microphones and processors and reverb units and all sorts of things that exist now that didn't exist when Neil Diamond was recording his songs, right? Was recording in a studio. So you need to decide, like, are we going to use that equipment? Are we going to emulate that equipment? Or are we going to use the technology that we have now and, you know, make it what it was and representative of what it was, but specific to this show? And that happens in conversation with the music department. But also I rely on the music department quite a lot to inform me about orchestration choices that they've made, right? The orchestrations for the songs in A Beautiful Noise are not exactly what they were on his albums, right? There, because we're, you know, a band of 12, whereas they, you know, he maybe had 15 people. I don't know what he had, but there's the instrumentation's a bit different. And so I rely on the music team a lot for that. But what I can say about the big stadium sequences is that there's a lot of layers happening. So we have sometimes the mic that comes up out of the stage is not used. It's actually just his headset. But we do use a 58 that's wired at the top of Act Two. In any case, so it's Neil, microphone, and then Neil's mic sends to a very short room reverb, which then makes his voice just a little bit bigger and puts it in the surrounds a bit with the reverb. Then the ensemble is also going to a tight room, actually a little bit tighter than the room that I'm sending Neil to because they're 10 voices, not one. So it's a pretty tight room. Again, that makes their voices a little bit bigger and puts them in the surrounds. Then I'm sending Neil, the ensemble, and the band to the surrounds dry. So I'm just putting them in the surrounds, period. So now they're in the surrounds, dry, in the surrounds with reverb that's really tight. And then, of course, the band has their own reverb, and the pre-delay and the decay of that reverb is based on the BPMs of the tune. So that changes with every number. And then all of those things, so Neil, ensemble, band, and his guitar that he plays. So each of those things go to their individual room reverb, and then each of those things also goes, like I said, to the surrounds dry, and then also goes to a giant reverb that's got like 100-something milliseconds of pre-delay on it and is like an 8-second decay or something that just like gives you that slap back of the stadium. So there's dry, there's like the normal dry, there's dry to the surrounds, reverb in the surrounds, and then a whole reverb that's just on top of all that other reverb. There's a lot of layers happening in those stadium moments to make it feel, again, how do we go from this tiny little two-person scene that needs to sound very natural and realistic to these giant stadium moments and pull it off and make it sound big?
That's awesome.
And I think we achieved that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I think we're a little bit past that hour mark. And now I will ask, although we sort of got to it already, is there anything else you wish we'd thought to ask of you that we haven't asked you about yet?
I don't think so. I mean, the only thing I'd like to add is that, you know, as much as I've worked in theater and I love it, I also really loved some of these audio dramas that I got to work on during the pandemic. And I am becoming increasingly fascinated with film and streaming mediums. And, you know, and I miss mixing concerts. So, but I love what I do. And I feel really blessed to be doing it. And I really hope that there are more and more women who choose to get involved in this field and are recognized for it.
They do.
That's all. Totally. That's my parting statement.
Awesome.
And do you have any strong feelings about doing theater in the rain?
Theater in the rain. Oh my God.
We won't use it on the photo, but I might break out in the Discord photos of me and Jess drying out a DM2000 in the pouring rain actually 10 years to the day before she won her Tony.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, wow, that's funny. Yeah, and then, you know, there, of course, were multiple incidences in the rain at the Delacorte where, you know, it was like 10 minutes before the show was supposed to end and the New York Times was there to review it. And it happened to be the artistic director of the public theater was the person who directed it. So there was no stopping, right? We weren't going to hold for rain. So it's just like this absolute downpour and you've got like 80 people on stage in 40 microphones and then Shayna Taub playing. She's double mic'd and she's got an accordion that's got a mic on her. So there's about $5,000 worth of equipment. Or maybe more, like probably like $6,000 or $8,000 worth of sound equipment on her body alone, and that's not
plus
counting
whatever the cost of the accordion is.
And then the accordion, and we are just doing the last 10 minutes of the show in pouring rain, and of course by the next day we had about 17 lobs that didn't survive.
Oh no!
And the bellows of her accordion did not survive. They had to get a new accordion. It was just like, when you added it all up, I think it was like $15,000 of damaged equipment.
Does it meet or exceed three DM2000s in a season?
Oh my God. I think it probably is equal. Yeah. I think it's equal. But I was just like horrifying. And everyone in the audience, and that audience, man, they are diehard. They are diehard. They sit there. They sit there in the pouring rain and they watch it.
They waited in a line for those tickets long enough. They're not giving that up.
And you're not allowed to take out umbrellas because it'll block other people from seeing the show. So you just have to sit there in the rain. It's crazy. It's wonderful. Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine what a soggy accordion sounds like, but I do not like the image.
Don't do it in my brain. Don't you do that to me, Andy.
Well, the bellows got wet. And so then what happened was they dried overnight and then they just cracked.
Oh, yeah. Very crispy.
They
crispy.
Just got brittle. They got, it was...
Nobody needs their accordion crispier than it already is. Like,
I'll never forget that.
What's the definition of a gentleman? Somebody who knows how to play the accordion but doesn't?
Absolutely.
There you go. And on that note, thanks, Jessica, for coming and hanging out. You were awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan and Heath and RCF for the sponsorship. That's the pod. See you guys next week.